Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the London School of Economics. I'm Wouter den Haan. I'm a professor of economics here at LSE. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest for this evening. But before I do that, a couple announcements. Professor Rogoff will first introduce his new book, The Curse of Cash. So after that, there will be an opportunity for you to ask him questions. Please turn off your mobile. I always ask this, and it still is not always effective. So there's always some people who embarrass themselves. The hashtag for this evening, for those of you who do like to use Twitter, is LSECash, which is on the screen. The event is recorded, and if the technique doesn't let us down, then we'll make a podcast available on the LSE events webpage. And then after the event, there's a possibility to get the book that you've bought outside signed. And the way it's going to work is that we're going to stay here on the podium, and then after you bought it, then it's just going to be your queue over here, and then you have the opportunity to get it signed. Okay, now the more important bit. It's my pleasure and honor to introduce our distinguished guest. Professor Rogoff is the Thomas D. Cabot Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University and former chief at the International Monetary Fund. Now, actually, lots of students, and I'm sure there'll be some here in the audience, who have been taught international monetary economics from his popular textbook, Foundations of International Economics, co-authored with Maurice Opfeld. There's so many things which are, you know, impressive, and I'm just going to mention just a few. Like, if you go to RAPEC, which is where we have all the rankings of academics, is that he's in the top 10 of many sort of lists, and like most citations and most published. And so the evidence of, you know, his prestige in the profession, not just only among academics, but also among policymakers, is he belongs to the very select group of 30, which consists of current and former policymakers and just a handful of academics. And if you're not impressed yet, he's also an international grandmaster of chess. And so I think we, as economists, we're very lucky that he's part of our profession. So please join me in welcoming Kenneth Rogoff.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here at LSE. I was actually a visiting professor in 1999, and I had a great year. I've been asked to make an announcement before I start that if you're making donations to LSE, cash is still fine. Anyway, I'm trying to this way. I guess I'll start it with a point about the title that I use for the talk, which is that my book is actually not about being cashless and not about abolishing cash. It's about getting rid of large notes like the $100 bill, the 500-euro note, and why that would be a good idea, more so than you might think. I have something you just can't understand in this Twitter social media age, amazed at the number of people who just look at the title and don't get any further and then write about, how do I pay for drugs, how do I pay for hookers, et cetera, and they get really angry about it, or how do I pay for guns. And it's actually, I think what I try to do is identify an issue. I suggest a possible approach to the issue. There are others. I mean, I think there's more than one way to skin a cat, at least as we say. I propose one that sort of describes what I think the idea is, what there might be to do about it. But if you actually read the book, which even many reviewers did not seem to do, I want to have cash forever. I actually think even after we have an electronic currency that's a central bank-issued currency, and we will someday, we still need physical cash for these obvious reasons of privacy. What happens if there's, EMP blast in the atmosphere? It's still convenient to have physical cash. Not necessarily paper currency. It might be something else eventually, but some physical currency forever. The first part, and really it's the main part of the book, is why might we want to have less cash? And it's very crude, and yet I find even people who run central banks and treasuries just really aren't tuned in to what the numbers are. Some of them are, but many of them are not. My main idea is to try to cut back on crime and tax evasion. So there's a sense in which this is talks about money but has really nothing to do with money. It's more a public finance issue, but there will be something about money later. And the basic fact is that there's you'll see vast amounts of currency floating around, and fundamentally we know where very little of it is. We know very little about where most of it is. When I wrote my first paper in 1998, which has many of the themes and a lot of the ideas that are in this book, there weren't so many surveys. There were just a few. There are a lot of surveys now. And, you know, just to throw a fact out in front of you, the average American holds something like $60, $70 on their wallet or purse. And maybe they have the same again or even twice that in their car, somewhere stashed in their car, cookie jar, whatever. But there are $4,200 per American outstanding outside the banking system, currency in circulation. A large share of that's in $100 bills. So in the case of the United States, 80% is in $100 bills alone, and then there's some further share that's in $50 bills. When I first wrote about this, certainly that point, I think, was known, but the Federal Reserve, at least, and the Treasury believe, well, yeah, it's being used for bad things, but not in the United States. It's being used outside the United States. So it's our dollar, their problem, to paraphrase Treasury Secretary under Nixon, John Connolly. What I showed in my 1998 paper was, well, other countries look pretty similar, Canada, the United Kingdom, not to mention countries like Japan, Switzerland. And, you know, we don't think Japan's currency is being used all over the place. And no offense to this audience, but I don't think the UK's currency is nearly as widely used as the U.S. currency. And yet, you know, you still see these very, very similar characteristics. There are differences. And I think, you know, you'll see now it's recognized that even though, yes, the euro is used in other countries, yes, the dollar is used outside the United States, a lot of it is internal. We can already see if most of the money is in $100 bills and we can't account for most of the money, obviously the average person's not reporting that they're holding these $100 bills. But for the United States, the latest survey data, at least that's in the book and that I have, is 95% of Americans never hold a $100 bill. 5% of Americans hold a $100 bill at least once a year. But remember, there have to be 34 for every man, woman, and child. Like the Germans say they like cash better, but actually the data's, they have a little more cash. It's not really that different than the United States. And so anyway, the claim is, and you know, I'll try to present some evidence. The book goes through it. Is that it's mainly used to facilitate trade in the underground economy, tax evasion, and crime. And you might want to think about at least what I would describe as the most light-handed approach, getting rid of the $100 bills. I should say before I proceed, you know, you sort of say, well, why write a book about that? It's sort of like obvious. Believe me, you know, if you read some of the controversy around this, a lot of people find it not obvious. There are a lot of subtle issues having to do with privacy. Central banks are very concerned about their profits. They make money printing this stuff. Why would we give that up? And then, you know, there are libertarian issues. There are actually, believe it or not, some very subtle theoretical issues having to do with what would happen if you completely eliminated cash or it became too close to treasury bills. And there was this brilliant monetary economist, Neil Wallace, who wrote about this in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And he hadn't imagined electronic currency, but he was sort of very well identified this issue that if the cash becomes too much, like treasury bills, it's all just electronic blips. suddenly central banks lose a lot of control over the money supply. And Wallace concluded that if you went too far in the direction I suggest, I mean, he again was looking at something a little different, but I think it's fair to generalize what he said to this. He said, it's going to blow up, and you will end up having to have gold or a commodity currency. It just won't work. You actually need this distinction with these physical bills. So some very subtle philosophical issues that surround this. But I'll talk more about it as the course of the talk goes on. Okay, if you decided that cash was a problem, what do you do about it? One idea that many European countries have done is to restrict the maximum size of cash payments. So it's different in different countries. I think in Greece it's €1,500. In Spain it's €500. France, €2,000. Italy, €1,000, though for some bizarre reason I think they just raised it to €3,000. Sweden, which is very much on the forefront of phasing out cash, has done a lot of things, but one thing they've done is if you have a cash register, it actually has to have a little black box in it that wires your transactions to the Treasury. They see them because a lot of the tax evasion comes from cash businesses where they sort of tear up the receipts at the end of the day, take the cash out of the till, and don't report it. The Internal Revenue Service, I'll show you a number later, but estimates that about 15% of taxes owed at the federal level in the United States are never paid, and that's after collection efforts. It starts out at a higher number, and 15% are never paid, and about half of that are cash businesses. And I haven't been around London so much in recent years, but I suspect in many European countries, if not the UK, there's a similar observation. If you travel around the U.S. anyway, you go into a store, retail store, if they take credit cards, you will usually have a lackey, some low-level employee running the cash register. I want you to observe that in the places that say we only take cash, you will much more often find the boss running the cash register or the boss's son running the cash register, et cetera. And the Europeans have done various things. So my idea back in 1998, at least when I started writing about it, was, you know, maybe the lightest-handed thing, the simplest thing to start with, would be to phase out these large denomination notes and make it more difficult to hoard, hide, port this currency. And if you think that's a joke, you have to understand that a lot of currency moves at a wholesale level. Now, I don't know if here you get the series Breaking Bad, one of the great television shows ever made, where they, you know, show the drug trade and Walter, the former high school chemistry teacher, who found he was much better at being a crystal meth lord, is making all this money, and his wife, who starts out very innocent but ultimately starts laundering all his money, it's actually quite a problem. She gets a car wash at first, and so she's pretending to have higher profits than the car wash really had. But Walter is just making too much money, and eventually they start having to store it. And it's actually very much more convenient to move around and store in these large denominations. And sorry to keep appealing to this, but there's another good television series called Narcos about Pablo Escobar, where they correctly identify, there's a lot of research on this, that actually moving the cash, so he makes money in the United States, but you want to bring some of it back to Colombia or wherever, it's actually a very expensive operation. And so whereas you can put $1 million in a briefcase and it weighs 22 pounds, if you had to use $20 bills, it's five times as much and expands, and with $10 bills, the same. So I was not the first to sort of worry about this. I hate the citation I have to give next, but Richard Nixon, we had a $1,000 bill at one point. Now, we had a $10,000 and a $100,000 too. They were mainly used for interbank transfers because, of course, we didn't have electronic transfers, and so that was a convenient way to settle things. We, in the United States, stopped printing the 1,000 note in the late mid-40s. but they were still legal tender. We in the United States have this somewhat unusual rule of making things legal tender forever. And at one point, they started sort of going out into the economy. My mother pointed out that if you read Damien Runyon's Guys and Dolls, there's actually a scene where they're gambling with 1,000 notes, which were worth about $10,000 in today's dollars. That was 1950. And that's, you know, a sign of, like, incredible extravagance that they're doing these $1,000 bills. What Nixon basically cited, that they seem to be being used for drugs and crime, and so let's get rid of them. There was an economist, James Henry, who was the chief economist at McKinsey, who wrote a couple magazine articles about this in the mid-70s, where he worried about these large bills, and he actually had a policy which was to just take them out of circulation really quickly. Those of you who are from India, we can talk about that. I'm going to come to that in a later slide. I sort of don't see that as the best approach, but I didn't originate this point. I think I did a lot of academic work on it and showed the scale of it and the universality. And then in recent years, very recently, Larry Summers has taken this up, which is great. I have to say, when I wrote my first paper, Larry was at the Treasury in the United States, and I don't know what his personal view on was. He was either the number two or the number three. But it came to Bob Rubin's attention. He was Rubinomics, this very famous Treasury secretary. He did a great job. He heard about my paper. I was not at all known, really, outside of, you know, certain small circles at the time. But there was a New York Times article about it. Nevertheless, it was such a weird idea. And he didn't focus in on what I would have wanted him to focus in on, which was getting rid of $100 bills. No, no. He saw my paper announce the coming of the 500-euro note, and he was sort of saying, darn it, if they're going to have a 500-euro note, we're going to have a $500 bill. And actually, I think, you know, people ask, has this work had any impact over the years? I don't know this idea. I think it has more impact than you think, because if you look at the value of how even $100 has gone down over time, of course they think about bringing out a $200 bill and a $500 bill. You've got to be kidding. And a lot of countries do that periodically. Again, that's what India just did. But this sort of argues by, you know, why that would be not such a good idea. My plan has a few elements, but the most important one is you do it really slowly so you don't have unintended consequences over several years, taking the largest bills, not all currency, out of circulation. And I have a financial inclusion piece I won't talk about too much that I don't, you know, I just think it's a good idea. The fact is that poor communities, you don't see the $100 bills all over the place anyway, except in immigrant communities, because, and I know this from talking to people at the Fed, that there must be some illegal immigration that's being paid in $100 bills, and so there's some use there. And these ideas aren't mutually exclusive. I want to emphasize, if you read the book, it sort of discusses the problem. You can form your own opinion. My idea of phasing out the large notes is not exclusive of other ideas, and I'm open to other ways to approach it. So another way to approach it is that you just take currency out of circulation and make it no good frequently, and you reissue currency. And most countries do this, but at very long cycles, say of 30, 40 years. Well, on the same day that the United States elected Donald Trump, India's prime minister went on national TV and made an announcement that in four hours, the two largest notes, the 1,000 rupee and the 500 rupee note, which constitute 85% of India's money supply, would no longer be valid legal tender. And he actually meant something stronger than that. You couldn't use it to buy stuff. And you had 50 days to turn it in, and they traded in for something good. And okay, on the one hand, he cited motivations very similar to what I give in Curse of Cash, of the not just tax evasion, crime, corruption. It's a very big element, of course, in a country like India. I've mentioned illegal immigration. I mentioned terrorism in the book, although I don't really regard that as the driving force, the big issue. Although I have to say, very recently, the Europeans took the 500 euro note out of circulation, which I wrote my first paper about why that was such a bad idea. And they knew all this, but I think the Paris terrorist attacks really tipped the balance. Anyway, that was mentioned. However, the strategy and implementation's quite different. I mean, India is a very different place that I haven't thought about nearly as much, but it's very different. First of all, he took the 1,500 out. I've already mentioned doing it overnight instead of doing it over a very long period, which is his idea is much closer to James Henry's idea, where let's get the bad guys. And my idea is I sort of felt that that's you're just taking down, you're shooting too many innocent civilians with the bad guys when you do it, at least in the United States, where I thought about it, that you want to do it very slowly. And, of course, they're actually doing it. He introduced a larger note, the 2,000 rupiah note, at the same time. I also, in the book, I'm very cautious about whether this is a good idea for developing economies. And I kind of say maybe in 30 years, maybe after the advanced countries that do it. And a big thing I point to is financial inclusion. A country like Colombia, which I know a little bit about, 50% of people are unbanked, whereas in the United States, it's a relatively small number. Remember, I'm not getting rid of smaller notes. And it's not such a big project to provide for financial inclusion. I think, in fact, most countries will. And I give a suggestion, a concrete suggestion in the book about, I think, a pretty inexpensive and straightforward way to do it. So certainly since Donald Trump got elected, people are asking me, well, you know, is the time ripe for this actually happening? He's, you know, very open to different ideas. And so would he consider getting rid of the large notes? And I've kind of got the idea, well, maybe he would if he realized that, you know, maybe he would buy into the idea of replacing them with new notes with his picture on it. I'm going to try suggesting that if I ever get a chance. I don't want to replace all the notes, but I'm not sure he's going to stop there. So anyway, people ask me, well, is this happening tomorrow? Is somebody going to do it? And I think you're motivated to write a book like this over a long period as opposed to an op-ed article because you're trying to have an impact over a longer period. I don't know. So just a bit of quantification. Is cash a major problem or a minor problem? Well, tax evasion is a huge issue, even in the United States, which is a high tax compliance country, not because we're good, but because most of it comes from income tax instead of value-added tax or sales tax. So the Internal Revenue Service estimate, which does not include illegal activity, it just includes legal activity on which people aren't paying taxes, is at the federal level, $500 billion, state and local taxes. We have a pretty good estimate on the $500 billion. They've done randomized audits and done a lot of work on that. State and local, much less is known, but they're about 60% the size of federal taxes, so the full tax evasion I'm giving an order of $700 billion. In the Eurozone, it's much larger. Both because tax compliance is much lower than in the United States in most countries, mainly because you have a sales tax that you rely on so much. And, of course, taxes are a lot higher. And I think there's a lot of evidence I pull together in the book about how a lot of tax and tax evasion and crime is fueled by cash. There was a organization in the United Kingdom which actually looked into this issue that had the name SOCA. Was this very somewhat secretive organization that they put together. It was over 5 years. It literally stood for the Serious Organized Crime Agency, which sounds like it's out of a James Bond movie, but it really existed. And they used the Treasury, the Central Bank, law enforcement authorities, did sting operations. And actually, they have booklets which really read like how to launder money, where it all goes. One of the early decisions that came out of that was that the UK banks made it much harder to use 500 euro notes here because it dawned on them that they weren't being used for much else besides cash and crime. I give a fair amount of evidence on this in the book, but fundamentally we don't know. So it just could be we're missing something. But there has been a lot of work, and it's certainly the case when you do look at various arrests and look at data, circumstantial data, the data you can find, there are a lot of big cash hauls. Sometimes you see a drug dealer arrested with $200 million and $100 bills in one of their houses. That kind of thing's not unusual. So some people say to me, okay, it's heavy cash, but cash is yesterday's crime. The young guys aren't using that. They're going to be using Bitcoin and other things. So aren't you just fighting yesterday's war and you're not really dealing with the real problem? And I think, in fact, into the foreseeable future, there isn't such a good substitute for cash. It's not that easy for the government. It's not that easy to use other things. The biggest difference is that if you have cash, you can use it anywhere. You can bring it to the bank. Now, admittedly, the anti-money laundering has made that harder to do in large amounts, but you can still, dole it out into smaller amounts, bring it to the bank, and you can spend it. You can spend it at stores. Most stores do take cash, and enough stores do. You can spend it very widely. Bitcoin or any alternative currency, the government has a lot of power to say you can't use it in banks or there's all kinds of paperwork and reporting. You can't use it at retail stores, which doesn't say that stuff couldn't happen on the sidelines. We've actually had this for a long time with uncut diamonds, gold coins. You can a lot of apartments in Miami, houses and apartments in Miami, New York, Los Angeles, are purchased with huge bags of cash. That's not uncommon. But gold coins are used. Uncut diamonds are used for these things. But they're very illiquid. So, for example, the gold coin actually has to be assayed and measured. And gold coin dealers can do this, but they're licensed and they're supposed to report this stuff, and you can only get away with it so much. There are other issues with Bitcoin about scalability. I will mention my book goes back 1,000 years, and as I think I first learned from Danny Hua in his lectures here at LSE, the Chinese invented the printing press, and one of their early uses was to print paper currency. They ended up having a big hyperinflation and executing everyone. This is a diagram of it. I think a thing that I show in the book, if you read the history and future, that's important is the people say, well, there are all these innovations in the private sector. Won't they put the government out of business? If you look at the history of money, the private sector often innovates and the government appropriates. So the idea of standardized coinage, which was one, I think, an incredible invention for doing commerce, came out of Lydia, which is, I guess, in western Turkey in 600 before Christ. But it was invented almost surely in the private sector first. There's some controversy about it, but and that idea spread like wildfire. Paper currency was used in the private sector both in China and when it was reinvented in Europe later before the government took it. And I think we'll surely see something like that with electronic currencies. So what about the complaint that governments make a lot of money printing cash? So there are different ways to calculate how much money they make, and it's a little more tedious than I have time to go into here, kind of depending on whether you want to make the argument that, well, if they couldn't issue cash, they would have to borrow money that paid interest, and then you calculate what that interest would be. And another idea is saying, well, they're providing this service that's very valuable. I try to use very high-end estimates so that nobody says, well, I'm exaggerating. And so for the United States, my baseline number is $70 billion. I think many people would say $30 billion was what the number was, which is what the interest cost of $1.4 trillion, the currency supply, if you had to raise it through bonds. But if you compare that, it sounds like a lot of money. I'm saying it's not. But if you compare it to the scale of tax evasion, the costs of crime, which is very hard to estimate, but every estimate, you know, is a multi-trillion dollar number, that if you can just get a few percent off these things, you're already breaking even. And so it's something I don't buy the seniorage argument. There's some arguments about central bank independence. Let me just race through a few graphs, and then I want to come to kind of like the more conceptual point, which is I will do my best to do it very concisely. So this gives U.S. currency in orange is what it was starting just after World War II. That's all of cash as a percent of GDP. So up there it's 10%. $100 bills were relatively small. Of course, $100 bill was worth $1,000 roughly in 1948. And John Dillinger, the criminal from, famously, had the big shootout in the 1930s, he used to carry around wads of mostly tens and twenties at the time. But over time, the hundreds have become much, much larger as a share of the cash supply. That's the United States. And currency's been rising. It's not only rising because criminal activity is rising. Of course not. The low interest rates, it's rising. There's been inflation. The value's gone down. But it's risen as a share of GDP. How much of this is abroad? I think virtually all estimates say at least 50% in the United States. These are what the Federal Reserve now, my estimate in my 1998 paper was 50% was in the U.S. And that's the Federal Reserve today actually has a lower estimate than that. So here in blue is all currency held outside banks, and in orange is the Fed's estimate. They have no idea, right? I mean, you can't go, frisk every Russian oligarch, but that's their guess in the orange that it's under 50%, closer to 40%. The euro is kind of the same story. So in blue is the total debt to GDP. So the U.S. is now 7.4%. Europe's over 10% of GDP. And if you do the notes 50 euro and above, it's over 90% of that total. And the 500 euro note alone is about a third of it. That's in orange there. The yen is that's a whole other story. They are almost at 20% of GDP in cash per person. Over 90% of it's in 10,000 yen notes. It's at today's exchange rate about $100. And I showed a lot of this stuff, I will say, in my 1998 paper. It's still very much true today. And this ranks countries by currency as a share of GDP. The Nordic countries have very much, I'm sorry, I'm missing a couple of countries there, and I didn't realize that when I don't know what I did when I resized the graph. We have Norway, Denmark, and Sweden are very small, whereas India is actually very big. Russia's in between India and Japan, and Japan's very large. The United States at 7.4%, 7.38%, sort of in the middle. I've also lost the UK. I'm sorry, I just did this today, and I apologize. The UK is about 4% is where GDP. And then I fear I have the same problem. I'll just skip this one. So that's it. It was true before the euro. A lot of countries like Spain and Italy had very high cash. So people say, well, we'd like to use cash, but we can't get rid of cash. And that's correct, especially for small payments. So this is from a 2012 diary survey that the Federal Reserve of San Francisco and Boston did. I'm actually going to update the numbers in a second because they just came out with new numbers. But actually, at that time, 40% of all retail payments, 40% were made in cash. But it only, that's the left-hand side in dark blue near the top. But only 14% of the value of transactions was in cash. And in fact, credit cards, debit cards, and electronic payments were all, you know, getting to be more. They were all more at that time. The cash numbers have dropped quite a bit. They just came out with a new, at least the preliminary versions of their data. The cash has gone from 14% of the value of transactions to 9% just over a few years. It's definitely falling. I think that's a trend you're seeing all over the world. And then again, if you look at different size payments, so here green is cash. If it's $0 to $10, two-thirds of payments are in cash. But on the other hand, if you're doing over $100, it's very small, the percent in cash. And I want to say this is the stores and individuals reporting this. Some of this is money being laundered, obviously. So it's even of the cash that we're seeing that's getting used in the stores is recycling from the underground economy. The underground economy is the United States is not a country with a particularly big underground economy. There are countries like Italy and Turkey that are much larger. This is a graph of seniorage as a share of GDP. I mentioned that number, 70 billion. The Eurozone is somewhat higher. There's something to say about Sweden, but I'll skip it. Sweden, what I will say that's not in my graph is one of the reasons Sweden is at the forefront of all of this is at one point in the, like, 2008 to 2010, they started having a rash of really violent bank robberies, you know, helicopter landing on the roof, blowing a hole through, dropping down on ropes and shooting people kind of thing. And the Swedish bank tellers just rose up in arms and said, we're sick of this. And they stripped cash out of many of the banks in Sweden. There are places in Sweden, Denmark, and Norway you can have to travel 100 kilometers to find cash if you want it, but there are many factors. So a second issue that I'm going to just treat very cursorily because I want to leave time for questions, and is the issue of the zero bound, which is so important for monetary policy. There's a lot to say about it. I'm not going to be able to focus that much of my talk about it, but let me make a few points. One is paper currency actually plays a role in why they can't cut interest rates below zero. You may know this or have thought about it already. I'll say something in a second. And a second point is that if central banks could have lowered interest rates even more during the crisis, they would have found it very helpful. I'm going to refer later to Janet Yellen's speech from just a couple months ago where she shows what you would do if you could have negative interest rates. And a point I'll repeat when I show her graph is it's just the very, very short term that's negative because you're reflating the economy and pushing up inflation expectations. You're actually tilting up longer term interest rates. But most studies show that at the height of the financial crisis, rather than some of the unorthodox policies that central banks did, they would have rather been able to appeal to deeply negative interest rates, and you see estimates like 4 and 5%. So paper currency plays a role here because paper currency pays zero, which back when I was a graduate student was a complaint we had about it because we had high inflation, which people thought would never go away. And now, of course, if we try to have negative interest rates, it suddenly seems wonderful that it's paying zero. So there's this issue of hoarding and how you deal with it. I argue in the book that if you took away the large denomination notes, it would let you go negative, as negative as you'd ever need. But you don't need to do anything to the currency supply to have to solve this problem. There's a very clever solution that was made during the Great Depression by Robert Eisler. John Maynard Keynes actually was very intrigued by this idea of negative interest rates. He was not aware of Robert Eisler's work. He followed another thinker, Silvio Gisell, who had a more cumbersome approach, and Keynes said, great idea, too cumbersome. Eisler's approach is very doable, very clever. It's been picked up recently by a few people, Willem Bouter, Miles Kimball have written very interesting stuff on this. I actually trace the idea back to Kublai Khan, who had a dual currency system. And their basic idea is you make electronic currency and paper currency have a different exchange rate. You'll have to read the book, but it's a perfectly good idea. You can decide, you know, which you think is better. Then I have a whole bunch of graphs about negative interest rates, some discussion about why there's a zero bound. And then the thing is, it's not just the cash. There are tax issues. In the United States, you can wait to cash a check. So what if there's a negative interest rate and I sit on the check that you sent me for a year? What if some rich person, you know, wants to prepay $1 billion in taxes, overpayment, and then collect it back? I would say they're pretty easy problems to most of these. What there's not such an easy problem is with the paper currency. And lastly, there are a whole lot of ideas to dealing with the zero bound. Again, you know, you can read the book. I think negative interest rates are massively the most elegant solution. They keep monetary policy at its limited purpose place that it is today and don't raise the problems that raising the inflation target would be. Don't have time to talk about it here. And some of the other plans that have been proposed. This was from Janet Yellen's speech in Jackson Hole. I see Ricardo there was presenting, Ricardo Reese. But she basically gave a talk saying, I know negative interest rates would be very elegant, but we're not planning to do that. But you don't have to worry. We can do quantitative easing. If you don't know what that is, you probably have already decided you don't want to. And forward guidance, and it's not a problem. And she presented a graph. But one of these things these graphs shows is that at least in simulations, if you could make the very short-term rates negative, it would move the longer-term rates up. Anyway, this is the cover of the book. My first paper had the title Blessing or Curse, and so I decided, you know, after working on it for 20 years, I'd come to a conclusion. I will be honest, I a little bit regret the title because so many people can't get past the title to see what the point of the book was. But anyway, such as that is what it is. And I will be happy to take questions.
So two requests, right? So please wait till one of the stewards hands you the microphone before you ask the question, and then try to keep it concise.
See a question here?
Hi, I'm Tom Keating from the Royal United Services Institute. Thank you very much for your presentation. I wanted to go right back to, I think it was the very first bullet point, which was with regards to restriction on cash payments. So the European Commission has just decided that that's something it ought to look at, partly triggered by terrorism and other things. Great variation across the EU. What's your perspective on that as a, you know, as a financial crime tool or as a tool in general?
So, I mean, I think these things need to be looked at, that we need to collect data on that. There is a lot of data that doesn't get collected to look at, and I'm open to ideas. I tried to pick the most light-handed way of doing it, which is the typical person, even if occasionally you want to make a $100,000 payment, it still only weighs 20 pounds, 22 pounds in dollars. So it's really only hitting the wholesale businesses and wholesale crime and tax evasion. But there are these other ideas. The Swedish idea of wiring the cash register is pretty straightforward. It's sort of hard to see what you disagree with about that, except the people who haven't been paying the taxes, which I hear a lot from. I mentioned in the book, if you kind of look futuristically, not that far in the future, cash as anonymous features are probably going to fade over time, because it's already the case that law enforcement agencies, in many countries, it's certainly true in Canada and the United States, you actually have to have the serial numbers of the bills that you took when you put into evidence. And they have these rapid scanning machines that read the serial numbers. And I believe, but I can't say for sure, with the new plastic currency like you have in Canada and now coming in the UK, it gets really easy to do. And you can probably, in the not-distant future, have cash registers where you feed the bills into the cash register and it's reading the serial numbers. There are lots of ideas about how to restrict cash usage besides having restrictions on the largest size of payment. But they're doing it for similar reasons. They're very frustrated. This is the tax authorities especially. And I discuss lots of other ideas in the book. Portugal, Greece, Brazil have had this idea of using lotteries for consumers, where if you turn in your receipts to the government, they will give you a lottery ticket. Portugal has given away something like 40 new Audis for people who have turned these in. And they found taxes have gone up much faster than consumption since they started doing that. Over here.
Hi, thank you for your talk. I'm Deep Biswas and I'm a government economist. What I was wondering was, you mentioned the case of India and sort of the phasing out of the 500 and the 1,000 rupee note. I was wondering, as you pointed out, because of financial inclusion and the lack of it veering towards 90-100% and the effect of on inequality, do you think it works as a measure in terms of the purpose in which Modi intended it to be?
So I think we won't know for a few years how it all worked out. The short-run costs are obvious. The long-run benefits are not. We won't know, and they might even be hard to measure when we do know. What I can say, I can say what I said in my book, which is my recommendation was not to do this the kind of rapid plan, but to phase it out over a long period, even though, as I try to give some quantification, I well understood that it would be much easier to launder the money over a longer period. I'm phasing out the large notes. They're not. They're eventually replacing them, bringing in larger notes. And I do think financial inclusion is important. That said, I have a lot of Indian friends from different walks of life. And, I get reports that one sort of described it as half the people think it's a disaster, half the people think it's a great idea. I think it's hard to know. And this is a country crippled by corruption, and I can see that it could be very popular to sort of strike very visibly at corruption. But it's outside the scope of what I studied. And again, what I wrote about developing economies in the book, and I restated a few times, and I won't overstate it, but I said I didn't see this as being something for developing countries in the near term. But they're doing something different. I mean, turning over the bills is a pretty typical thing. In fact, India has done it many times in the past. What is not typical is doing it this fast rate. It was suggested by this economist James Henry in the mid-70s, who's very thoughtful. But, yeah, that's as much as I can say. I wrote a blog post on it, which I think LSE reposted, trying to clarify that. over here.
Hi, I'm Jake Alchek. I'm a grad student in the Economic History Department. You talk a little bit about how criminal enterprises won't use Bitcoin, but have you considered that the incentives to innovate, if a large cash is out of the system, could that spur technological innovations within Bitcoin or other methods? And have you thought about that at all?
Well, I discuss it in the book, which doesn't necessarily mean I figured it out. I mean, I certainly worried about it, and I discussed that whole issue. I do think when you prevent people from using it in retail stores and especially from taking it to financial institutions, you make it much less liquid. You raise the transaction costs. Ultimately, if you're doing anything on scale, you've got to launder it. I know early on when I was studying this, I had asked a student that I thought was particularly technologically savvy to my office and said, can you explain Bitcoin to me? And he looks at me, but I don't use drugs. So if you want to hire a hitman and, certain things. But that's always been true of gold coins and uncut diamonds. They had very, very high transactions costs. And I'm very careful in the book that I don't say you're wiping out crime. I just sort of say what you're doing is penny wise and pound foolish. You're giving up the seigniorage cost. That's really what you're giving up. It's a very slight inconvenience to most people because most people aren't using these notes, at least according to their self-reporting and other surveys. Of course, we had crime before we had the Lydian coins. So clearly criminals, can figure out how to operate in any environment. And there are many ways to do money laundering. Again, you can read the Serious Organized Crime Agency report. But this seems to me like something relatively straightforward to try. I would also mention, I think negative interest rates is much the most elegant future for monetary policy. You don't have to do it this way. But I argue in the book that maybe it's the cleanest way to do it.
So is there any evidence that crime or illegal activity in general have been trending up and to make the call more urgent now?
I thought it was pretty urgent in 1998, so I haven't really dramatically changed my view about it. So you're from Argentina, if I'm not mistaken. So this is a country, which certainly has a lot of corruption, tax evasion, crime, and very creative people, doing it in all sorts of different ways. Even people have asked about the case of Sweden and the Scandinavian countries. Has it gone down? And I think, as you well know, it's much easier. It's much harder in a single country. There are things to control for. For example, in Sweden, they've had a huge surge in immigration. How do you control for these different things? But no, what we know is the money's not being used much in legal activity. That's what we know, and we don't know where it is. But they do uncover it at times, and when they have drug busts. I have to say that I was amused by a recent news report where in the Soviet press, where they even Russia has an anti-corruption agency, and the official who, at least as TASS told it, was a relatively high-ranking official in their anti-corruption agency, they went into his apartment and found $130 million and mostly in $100 bills. Anyway, there's a lot of things you can find, but it'd be very good to put together a coherent database. It'd be good if the Justice Department reported every time they seize cash. It would be pretty easy to pull together, but they haven't done it. So I'm not saying we know, but this strikes me as pretty light-handed, at least what I'm suggesting, a fairly light-handed approach. We also know in Europe, they've certainly put in all these measures out of concern out of this, presumably because they catch people and find things out.
Hi, Eva Rauer. I'm an LSE applicant. In your ideal, what would the highest denomination American bill be? Would you just phase out the 100 bill or maybe some others?
Yeah, so what I say in the book is fairly quickly, and this is over, you know, say 3 to 7 years, depending on how you do it, let's get rid of the 100s and 50s. And then another, I think I say 10 years, 15 years, let's do the 20 if you've done financial inclusion, if cash has continued to trend down in the way that it seems to be, then I would go down to $10 bills. And then I say maybe in another 40 years after that, I would replace them with coins, which are even heavier to carry around in any large quantities. But I think the 100s and 50s that I first wrote about in 1998, I feel pretty strongly about. Whereas, by the way, some people say, well, why not just wait? Like inflation will do the trick. But right now, it would take a long time for inflation to do the trick. And also, again, I'm not really just campaigning to get rid of these, but if you don't have an argument to the contrary, you're going to see 200s, 500s, and many countries do this.
Thank you. I'm Nadia Farr, and I work in cash strategy at a global bank. I'm just wondering, do you think that banks, when faced with an increased cost of processing small denomination notes, could take your light-handed approach and potentially push it into a full-blown cashless society?
So I couldn't. So you asked if they found a more efficient way to do small transactions. Would we get rid of the small notes too?
It increases the cost having to obviously process high and smaller denomination notes. So but the bank I'm working for is thinking of phasing it out altogether as a means of transacting for their customers.
Yeah, but I mean, where I'm going at this is trying to bifurcate it, that there are these large notes that seem to be very little used in the legal economy. You're not affecting ordinary people in how they buy things privately, and you're much more affecting people who are trying to find ways to hoard cash and avoid government taxation. I don't favor into the distant future getting rid of the smaller denominations. Again, the 20, you know, we can talk about, because I do think there are issues like privacy where, you know, electronic currency are just not going to do it. Now, and of course, the government can't allow a completely anonymous electronic currency, because then that would just blow up and magnify all the problems.
The balcony.
I'm so sorry. I'm like, I must. Okay, so we have a few questions. I'll get to them. So one here and one there. And there are three questions, I see.
Two quick questions. On the question of privacy, there was some debate in London when the buses stopped taking cash and it was just ignored. Do you think that's a case where especially for low wage individuals they should be allowed to? And secondly, in the US, of course, a lot of states are legalizing marijuana, and wondering if that's sort of another way of getting around the problem is bringing the illegal activity into the real economy.
So in marijuana, I talk about that in the book, and of course, and I talk about the scale of what it is, which is it's certainly big, but I think the number I give of the total underground activities on the order of $40 billion a year, that's the RAND estimates. I don't really know what it is. I favor making it legal for lots of reasons, but I don't think that would begin to address all the problems that we see. Before I answer your question about the buses, I have to say I went to Denmark a while ago and was presenting some ideas from this. And I met a leading labor union organizer there. And he was telling me, you know, I went to the UK for the first time. And I took a black cab. And, of course, here I don't carry cash. Why would you carry cash? No one uses cash in Denmark. I try to pay with my credit card. He won't take it. I'm kept a prisoner in the taxi for 2 hours until I could negotiate getting cash. So there's transitional problems. I don't have a glib answer on the bus question. I take buses all the time, and our buses in Cambridge still take cash, although I almost never see anyone using it. But I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't have a glib answer to that. I have a couple more questions up here I'm going to take.
Two questions. Firstly, isn't the combination of quantitative easing plus negative interest rates plus abolition of cash a paradigm case of government totalitarian control over the individual? And secondly, I noticed that you seem to go seamlessly from recommending the abolition of $100 to $50, and then you were talking about anything over $10, which is an absolutely piffling amount of money. As you said, most Americans carry around with them all the time something between 60 and 70. So to prevent people from having even small amounts is just an appalling retreat from liberty. And I thought the US was supposed to be all about liberty.
So are you carrying 50-pound notes with you now?
Sorry?
Are you carrying 50-pound notes with you now?
Not today, but on some days and for some purposes, I might be.
You know, first of all, you know, there are a lot of surveys about this. You use the word abolition of cash, which many journalists covering my book freely go to that, or people who are summarizing my book, and that's ludicrous. Because if you look at how cash is actually used and you look at the data and you look at studies, most people don't rely on that. And you think it's hard to carry around $70 if you don't have a 50. I mean, your currency is a little bigger than ours, but I don't think it's so burdensome. I think I've gotten a lot of hate mail and actually quite a few death threats from, you know, people who say, you know, I provide something people want and you're going to make my life way harder and you're going to make it miserable. I also get emails from businesses that say, you know, I pay my taxes, I do things straight up, but the auto dealer, the used car dealer down the street pays for everything in cash and only takes cash. I have a very hard time competing. I don't think that – I take it to this extreme of you're going to have a totalitarian state versus, you know, total libertarianism. Do you favor having a $10,000 bill? I mean, the question's where to draw the line, how do you calibrate it, or for goodness sake, let's think about it, of what the issues are. I'm perfectly well willing that – studies are done and people find differently than I find and they uncover new data and discover that, you know, actually this is, you know, they're all being used in legal activity that's hidden from everything. But I'm very skeptical that we'll find that. So I'm trying to find a light-handed approach. And you blend quantitative easing and negative interest rates into this, which are non sequiturs, I think, in this. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely the right question. You can read the book, and I try to give a nuanced answer. But I think you have to be very careful not to jump to an extreme about where you want to stand on this. I've had a question over here.
Hi. The idea that your kind of main argument about cash being bigger, physically bigger, when you lower the denominations, and that's going to make crime, hoarding, money laundering, moving cash harder, is intuitively appealing. And I was wondering whether either in your book or elsewhere in the literature there were studies to kind of back that up in terms of how much harder does it make crime? Do we know? Linked to that, have you done any thinking in the book about other negative consequences that could come from making cash drawers bigger? So criminals presumably won't give up. They will, you know, they will have to bribe more border guards. They will have to buy bigger boats and submarines, and you know, guerrilla armies will have
to be
in the jungle, etc., etc. So, and I just wonder if the you know, that how confident we can be that the negative effect in terms of reducing crime will be bigger than the negative effect of the extra corruption that will come from bigger amounts of cash, or indeed maybe the extra resources that criminal groups will put into subverting the electronic systems, you know, into, I don't know, bribing or subverting or hacking electronic cash systems, and how much work's been done on that?
Well, I mean, there's a little bit, but basically we don't know the answer to that. We do know what's going on now. It's going on in lots of different countries. And all you can do is try to address it, I said, in a very light-handed way. If it turns out that the cash supply doesn't change, for example, and people just find very efficient ways to carry around these smaller bills, you know, I mean, I think first of all, seniorage won't have changed. Ordinary people probably won't be affected very much, and it will turn out not to have much effect. However, I'm trying to identify the problem. I'm trying to suggest a light-handed solution as it's studied more. You can use a mix of things. Sweden has certainly turned to a mix of approaches in trying to deal with the problem. I want to say also, I'm in tax evasion, I don't think of this as necessarily trying to raise more money, as you know, one reviewer described my book as a left-wing, crotchet, I think he said, because I wanted to just raise taxes. I mean, this is about tax fairness. So if you raise taxes but you're not raising government spending, you can lower other people's taxes. And the issue comes up also, by the way, as some Canadian studies show, with giving welfare, where you want to give welfare, you want to give poorer people more money, and to the extent people can earn money other ways and not report it, and so you're trying to have a graduated plan but you're not successful in it, can interfere with the public support for programs like that. But I think, of course, I feel we can think about identifying these problems, and I try to offer a solution, but I'm not wedded to that single solution. There are other ways to approach it. Sorry? The microphone's, I think, going to come.
The problem you're trying to solve is primarily one of tax evasion, whereas most of the concerns are around privacy. And these are two different subsets, almost, of people. The ones who are evading taxes that this solution is supposed to tackle happen to be a different set of people than the ones who have privacy concerns. So, by rare example, the people who are at the paying end tend to be the ones more concerned about privacy, whereas the ones on the receiving end are the ones typically evading taxes. The solution, the Swedish solution, seems to be a more plausible way of going about solving this problem without necessarily hurting the privacy rights of individuals. So the one related to a direct line to the Treasury. I mean, so you're really trying to catch people getting the money, and you're trying to account for that money rather than
Yeah, you're dismissing crime as being a source of this, where you're not going to catch it with the direct line to the Treasury. I think the privacy issue is very important, and it's just a question of, you know, order of magnitude. You can make a payment for $500 pretty conveniently in 20s. Most of my life, when I've ever done it, that's what I did. You can buy an apartment. You can make a $100,000 payment pretty easily. Now, if you're doing it every week, as some of the emails that I've gotten have said, I do $50,000 transaction every week in my business, and I need the big bills. And I was like, okay, what's your business? You know, that you actually have to be doing that. So it's a question of calibration. We do lots of things, you know, where we try to balance individual rights and public rights, and I would just say, I think it's been out of whack for a long time. And I would point to the fact that cash usage is going down. I don't live here, but I've certainly seen the data. I actually think you're ahead of the United States in many ways. Young people in big cities barely carry cash anymore. My son Gabriel worked at Starbucks 2 summers ago. I'm old. I still use cash, so I'm one of the people carrying $60 or $70 or more around. And I went in early one afternoon, and I paid in cash. And Gabriel said, he didn't even know about my book. He said, "Dad, you're the only person who paid in cash today. You know, what's wrong with you?" I think we're going to see this trend more and more. I have to say, I used occasionally in the process of writing this book, I used $100 bills around Boston, around New York, and I got all kinds of reactions. It's a little easier in New York than it is in Boston. And, you know, they go like this and like this, because I've got to say, the new $2,000 bills are somewhat harder for the North Koreans to counterfeit. They'd been doing it perfectly up until then. But you have to know, you have to have a PhD to know whether it is or not. So they'd show it to three people. I had one lady say to me, you know, "I'll have to pay for this." And, you know, I gave her a credit card. But the best line I had was, I went into, I think it was a watch repair store, and I used a $100 bill. And he looks at it and he says, "Okay, fine, but I'm going to need three forms of identification if you want to use them." But I think part of why there'll be a tipping point, and you just look at this data, the payments in cash are collapsing outside small payments. But I think we do need it for having privacy. It's a question of balance. I think, you know, you make a good point about the Swedish solution sort of hitting the nail on the head, but it's not capturing all the transactions. There are a lot of cash transactions that we would regard as legal that aren't taking place that way. I started to ramble, but I've been doing this for so long. I've heard so many stories. I was telling a doctor of mine, she said, "You're working on something?" "Yeah, I have this book, and it's about getting rid of big bills. Nobody carries around hundreds." "What do you mean nobody carries around hundreds?" "My dad always has like wads full of hundreds." And I said, "Well, what does he do?" It's like a home decorating business that he runs out of the house." And I said, "You know, I bet he is avoiding taxes, and that's why he's doing it." And she says, "Yeah, you know, I've never seen him go to an ATM machine." And then she finally says, "Do you think my mom knows?" But I, you know, there are changes, and I intend, I recommend doing it gradually.
Hi, my name is Martin. I'm an economist. My question is, both in data and in neuroeconomics, we've seen that it actually like hurts when we pay with cash. And this is somewhat irrational when we see that it doesn't hurt as much to pay with, let's say, a credit card. Do you think the society with less cash, the less cash that you propose, will make this irrationality bigger?
So there's certainly people who say that I like to just put a certain amount of money in my wallet, and I know when I'm done spending it, I replenish it. And the first thing I'd say is, if that's really the issue, there are trivial technological solutions to this, which is, you know, we can have cards which are having in bright letters, you know, how much money you have left on it so that you're aware of it. I didn't mention issues that they've navigated in the Nordic countries with having PINs, personal identification codes, to make it much safer. What do you do with people who simply can't remember that many digits for what, you know, by birth or possibly because they're old? And they've found very simple, low-tech solutions to these things, like having people go to the bank and put money on a card which is like cash. It would get stolen, they lose it, but they don't lose all their money. I think a point you raised that's very good is there are a lot of psychological elements and emotional elements to cash. Again, why I would say to do it slowly, of any plan that you have. Sorry, do we have a question here? Or let's see, maybe just a couple more here at this point, because I don't want to run out your patience. I enjoy the topic, but maybe you only enjoy it up to a certain point. So maybe I'll take two more questions.
A couple more in the balcony.
I'll take one here and then one up there. Sorry, is that another one?
Hi, I'm Philip, an undergraduate here at the LSE. So my question was, because you know, you talked about how electronic forms of cash are being increasingly used at the expense of paper money, and all of that's being processed by companies which produce payments devices, which have all sorts of electronic systems, and there's only a handful of these companies. So now there's supposedly going to be an increased public concern as to how they use information or what the price competition there is in that industry. So is the debate about how to regulate them, how to maybe treat them as government utilities, is that something that you cover in your book as well? Thank you.
So I discuss all this in the book. One thing I would say, this is happening anyway, with or without my plan. I mean, the fact is, in the legal economy, it's happening anyway. A lot of the cash, I think, is being used otherwise. There are reasons that it's such a monopoly, having to do with what they call the rails of the payment system, which are limited, but there are ways the government can significantly expand them and create more competition and drive down the prices. The banks are fighting that because they have a monopoly on the existing ones. I kind of think this problem will get solved over the next 5 or 10 years, with or without phasing out cash or whatever is going on. Eventually, again, I discuss this at length in the book, there'll be a government currency which provides a very low cost for many kinds of transactions. I'll just take one last question here.
You speak about the potential benefits for, I suppose you call it, economic management of negative interest rates. Isn't this rather a lot of power to arrogate to the central banks? And to sort of put a little urgency on the question, President-elect Trump in 2018 has a hand in replacing Janet Yellen.
I mean, he seems to be gravitating towards gold bugs and other such, so... By the way, I think going back to the gold standard, it's about as smart as having the United States adopt the euro. But I don't know, you know, what's going to happen. I think the fact is that the central banks have an immense power to create inflation already. And we have a problem that the inflation rates we have don't lead to a general level of interest rates sufficient to accommodate monetary policy in severe recessions. And the question what to do about it, this is a huge topic on which they have great courses at LSE. And I invite you to read what I say about it in the book. And I'd only, you know, succinctly say that if you're able to do it right, Japan hasn't, Europe hasn't, you lay the groundwork. It's not so straightforward. And importantly, the central bank cannot do it on its own. It needs the whole government to lay this groundwork. Then you restore monetary policy. You don't care if the target's 2%. You restore normal monetary policy. It doesn't mean you don't use fiscal policy. It doesn't mean you don't have structural reform, et cetera. But it gets rid of this zero bound. There are so many wacko ideas out there for what to do because interest rates are at zero. For example, Barry Eichengreen at Berkeley wrote a piece saying, well, maybe Trump and Sanders are right about protectionism because that would raise prices, and we need inflation right now. Larry Summers and Paul Krugman and some co-authors of probably the person who is really the creative mind behind this was Gowdy Egertson at Brown, structural reform. No structural reform, because that's going to lower prices, and that's bad when we're at the zero bound. And they work in a little model, but it's not something you want to do in the steady state. And I could go on to helicopter money, having the government buy up corporate debt. Oh, yeah, that's what they're doing in Europe. These are ideas which you're doing because you can't use normal interest rate policy. It doesn't mean they're all bad ideas, by the way, but you'd like to not have this excuse. You'd like to take it out of the equation. So my idea is really to restore normalcy rather than being something perverse. But I invite comments, and especially if you read the book, invite comments on it. So anyway, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be back at LSE.